My guest on today's show is John Sarnay. He's been named as a top five futurist in the world, meaning he knows more about AI than pretty much anyone on this planet. He's written 11 books. Five of them have been named as bestsellers. He's done multiple TED Talks, and he's someone who's regarded in the industry as having a bit of a prophecy when it comes to understanding what comes next in AI. How is it going to impact our lives as individuals, as organizations, and indeed, even our values? Am I saying your name right, Sarnay?
Sarnay is good. Yeah. Yes, very good. Well done.
It's got one of those names where you can pronounce it three or four ways, right?
Yes, and it's been pronounced eight different ways, depending on who's pronouncing it, which stage I'm on.
Yeah.
I used to be a bodybuilder when I was a kid.
And, did you?
I won junior essays.
Yeah.
And they used to always introduce me as Johan Sarnay.
My goodness.
I was like, I don't even know who that was.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, it sounds Japanese as well.
Phonetically,
it looks like it's Japanese.
You know what's so funny? There's a bus brand in Japan called Sarnay Bus Brand. And somebody sent me a picture of it online. It's like, is this you? I'm like, it's not, but I've never seen another Sarnay brand
you're
anywhere.
You're expanding your horizons, right? You're trying new industries. John, is there something that you haven't done? Because look, I've done my research on you. We had a call yesterday about it. And you've done so many different things. Now, the fact that you told me that you were a bodybuilder in the early days just adds again to the mystery of who you are. But in a nutshell, at your core, you're a futurist, right? You're someone who essentially predicts the future, specifically around AI.
Look, I don't think predict is the right word.
Okay.
I think it's extrapolate existing trends around culture, technology, social, geopolitical. And what you do is you almost like converge them. And then what you do is you try and categorize and contextualize them so that people can have a more optimistic view of engaging with it.
Yeah.
I think most people are petrified of the future. Today it's AI. If you think about it, 2 years ago it was crypto.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, a year ago, two, 3 years ago, it was metaverse.
Yeah.
And so there's always something on the horizon that people feel uncomfortable with. And my job really is to try and develop a level of calmness so your decision-making process is both courageous, but also linked to what's actually coming, not what you've always been used to, which is really the trick here, is because most of our brains are tricking us into keeping things confined and keeping things small.
Hey, before we go any further, talk to me about your mug. What's going on here? Why this?
George Clooney.
Okay.
And I remember seeing the first Nespresso ad that he was on. And I don't know why, but I connected this type of glass with success. And I actually made a post about this recently on social, talking about how to celebrate our small successes along the way. And the picture of was of me holding this mug, overlooking the view of my apartment. And I was like, I, for the longest time, have dreamed of living, quote unquote, a successful life. And having a Nespresso in a cup like this, for me, is kind of this little nuanced success that I've been kind of dreaming of when I was younger. I come from a single mom background. So these little wins for me are important. So this represents my newfound success.
So would it be fair to say that you're the Persian version of a George Clooney?
Look, I mean, anything to have any resemblance of George Clooney in any way is a wonderful thing.
No, you're a good-looking guy. You've obviously got a Safa accent as well, because
That's right.
You've lived and you've
Cape Town.
Yeah, you've lived your whole life pretty much in Cape Town before you came here.
I lived in London for a few years,
okay.
And then 6 years ago, I decided to come to Dubai.
Okay, well, Dubai is happy to have you. John, you've done a lot of different things, a lot. Like, it's impressive.
Thank you.
Like, you've written books, you've co-authored books. Five of them are bestsellers. You've got your podcast, The Expansive. Which how long has it been going on for? How many episodes have you recorded?
280 now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as one podcaster to another,
yeah,
I take my hat off to you.
Yeah, that's a lot.
You've done four TEDx talks.
TEDx talks, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What else? What am I missing?
Look, I mean, it depends which way in my direction you want to go. I've done close to 100 ayahuasca ceremonies. I've done maybe 40 or 50 psychedelic ceremonies. I made a mission.
What's a psychedelic ceremony?
Utilizing magic mushrooms to go deeper into your consciousness.
Really?
Yeah.
So, but when does that happen?
Happens all over the world,
to
be honest. Yeah.
Not here, though, I'm guessing.
Definitely not here. And even if it was here, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing it here. But I've traveled extensively. Last year, we did 80 talks in about 60 cities. So I'm continuously on the road and continuously seeking out. In fact, I'm filming a new documentary called My Life is a Lab. And it's really about how do you lens the growth of consciousness and human awareness throughout the world. And so I'm developing this documentary to try and pick up on all the things that I'm learning around the world. So the psychedelics is also a part of exploring aspects of ourselves that we often don't get access to.
It's like a subconscious, I'm getting.
Well, look, I mean, you know the story that, you know, your conscious brain is 10% of your consciousness. It's like an iceberg. And we often don't get access to our subconscious.
We need help.
We need altered states. And your altered state can come from meditation, can come from psychedelics, can come from ayahuasca, whatever the case may be. But what has happened also in our society is we've created this idea and stigma around them being drugs. You know, it's funny
It's a naughty word, right?
Well, the funny thing is that we somehow think it's okay that some guy in a white lab, in a white coat, can subscribe anything to you, like a Ritalin, whatever it may be, and you can drink as much whiskey as you like, but God forbid you go through a psychedelic. I mean, God, now your life's falling apart. So I think that society's deemed it in a way that is not positive. And I think that's totally wrong. It's just been a bad, systemized messaging about it.
So when you're in that state, what's the thing that you've learned most about yourself or discovered about yourself that you thought was, oh, hold on a second, that caught me off guard?
That most of your memories are false. All of us are made up of memories, and our human experiences develop our personalities, behaviors, and perspectives of the future. And if you've got traumatized memories, which most of us do, our future then becomes a replication of our past. And
you're
so
just extrapolating the past.
Constantly extrapolating. You're constantly in a loop. You don't even realize you're in a loop. Everybody's in a loop. And neuroscience is proving to us that we have between 60 and 70,000 thoughts a day, of which 90% are the same thoughts as yesterday. And many of our thoughts are based on memories that we often dramatize. These memories aren't even real. You know, think about somebody that maybe had a bullying incident at school. And later on in life, you're feeling down and you're feeling upset about something. And you'll think of that memory again and you'll dramatize it to give you this more gravitas around acting in certain ways. And what mostly has happened is that the rewiring of your brain is actually a rewiring of your memories. And so that's the biggest thing, is that most of our experiences are subjective stories we've decided to hold on to.
Which we're going to get into in a bit as well. You mentioned meditation just before.
Yes.
You meditate a lot.
I'm an advanced meditator.
So talk to me, how often do you meditate and how? What's your trick when it comes to meditation? Because there are different types of meditation forms, right?
So I'm a Dr. Joe Dispenza student, and he's a very specific type of meditation. He's developed meditations that are called active meditations, and they're very different to mindfulness meditations. And so what most of us think about meditation is we have to sit quietly somewhere and find the Zen within us. And I think that's, of course, one type of meditation, and important to go into what I call nobody, nowhere, no time. You want to lose yourself in a way, and that's a great break from the insistent thinking that we always have. But what Dr. Joe Dispenza teaches you is that moving to mindfulness is only step one. Step two is to, in that space of being nobody, nowhere, no time, is to start to rewire your brain with intentionality, with stories, with ideas. And he takes you on a journey that's guided. So he has 15-minute meditations and four-hour meditations. And so I usually do between 2 to 3 hours a day, because I understand that the process of meditation does two very clear things for you. It helps you focus what you want to focus on. And when you realize that most people can't meditate, it's because they can't focus on what they want to focus on. Their brain is telling them what to focus on.
If you have ADHD, can you meditate?
Most people have ADHD. And it's because the way our brains have been wired for a world of certainty and for a world of scarcity. And today we live in a world of abundance and uncertainty. So most of us have got ADHD. And so, yes, and the point of ADHD is you can't focus your brain. And so meditation gives you the opportunity to become fitter in what you focus on. And the second thing that meditation does, it gets you to focus on uplifting emotions. Think about yourself when you come back from a holiday. You're a totally different person. You have a very uplifting idea. Your brain has lots of energy to solve many problems. You realize that many of the problems that are in your life have been created by you. There's so many aspects. And so what happens is we only really get that after a holiday. In our normal lives, we don't have access to that. What meditation does, it gives you an opportunity to elevate your perspective daily, twice a day. And you realize that when you approach your life like that, there's just so much more opportunity around you. There's so much more optimism around you. And that then determines your behavior and how you create it.
I can tell after about 8 minutes of talking to you that I've never met anyone like you.
Wow.
There's a certain level of security that you have in your own mental state. Like, I feel like no matter what happens, Right? No matter what anyone says, inside you will know exactly who you are, your DNA to your core, and you're unshakable. Does that ring true to you?
Well, firstly, thank you so much for the compliment. I think years of self-development and accessing the subconscious and hours and hours of meditation obviously give you that internal stillness.
How powerful do you feel?
More powerful than I've ever felt because of the constant work. It's a momentum building compound process. And when the journey started, my self-development journey started, it started and catalyzed by bankruptcy. You know, in my 20s, I was exceptionally successful, but financially, not really emotionally. And in my second book, I started off with a line that says, are you running away from the darkness or are you running towards the light? And most people are running away from the darkness. And when you look at somebody who's ambitious, one person's anxious, one person's excited. And the anxiousness has somehow become the benchmark of how everybody shows up. And they think, well, just anxiousness is normal. It really isn't. It shows a lack of fitness. And so I made so much money and I was so excited. And I was so anxious about making more. And when that all fell apart, I began the journey. And so it's been 20 years of this process of digging deeper into my consciousness. And this has really helped my career grow immensely because of just the deep work that most other people don't do.
Which we're going to get to as well. Before we go any further, safe word. Do you have a safe word?
Gimp.
Gimp. You know what? Yeah. That's a first on the show. I'm delighted that you went down that road. Do you know how many people have said pineapple to me?
Of course, yes. So those are the normal ones.
So why? Okay, as someone who's a smart intellectual, yeah, you know, understands the subconscious of a human being, why people keep using pineapple as a safe word?
Because I think it's the one that's been shared on socials and movies as just a funny thing, you know? Okay. And I don't think most people go.
So it's echoing. It's rather than there's something subliminally inside us that.
Because I think the safe word also is linked to the world of S&M and the world of that sort of sexual expression. And most people aren't in that world. And so if you are in that world, you've spent time doing that. If you haven't spent time in that world, then pineapple seems to be the only one that you've picked up on in social media.
So your mental state, going back now, your mental state is in such a strong position, it's helped your career, right? And your career fundamentally is about helping businesses prepare for the future, right? It's about inspiring audiences to think and believe in themselves or look at themselves in a different way where they can find a deeper sense of optimism about the future so they can embrace it. To embrace that adventure spirit that sits within them and to unlock the capability that we all have as human beings. Is that a fair assessment of your career and what you're doing, or am I way off base?
You've done such great research. You were so impressive yesterday when you were telling me all those things, and thank you so much for putting the effort in. Just to simplify all of it, I simplify the future, I elevate your awareness, and I restructure your thinking.
Simplify the future for me. What is the world of AI going to look like in a very simple layman's terms? So I can explain it to my 75-year-old mom.
The answer is nobody knows. But the better way to want to describe it to somebody in layman's terms is to go back to explain how much has already been disrupted. You know, as human beings, we don't realize we live in such a disrupted world. You know, I'll make a comment sometimes on social media about AI and people will say, that's just too much. I can't engage with that. And my response to them is, you're sitting on a cell phone in the middle of your lounge, talking to me 12,000 kilometers away on an internet that you can't see, but now it's all of a sudden too much. You don't realize you already live in a disrupted world.
How far we've come, yeah.
Exactly. And so the analogy is this, is that in the agricultural era, for 10,000 years and for 500 generations, the way you added value to the world was through your physicality. So the way you understood the seasons, the way you followed your forefathers, and the way you brought your physical strength to work the fields. The way you added value was measured through horsepower. And we went from a third of a horsepower, which is you and me, to a horse, to a truck with 5 horsepower, to a car and a ship with thousands of horsepower. And today we have 70 million horsepowers with rockets going up into the sky. Do you see yourself as adding value with horsepower?
No, I've just imagined 70,000.
70 million.
Sorry, 70 million horses, million horses going up into the sky.
Like, think about that. That's unconceivable. Yeah. But you don't think of yourself as a physical being. And so when the Industrial Revolution arrived, it made our physicality irrelevant. But guess what? In the agricultural era, nobody knew what was next. They just had to continuously evolve into a process of understanding the next step was algorithmic intelligence.
I'm glad you brought up the agricultural sort of evolution of where we came from. The old days, we used to wake up very early to plow the fields, right? Yes. Men wake up 4 a.m., 5 a.m., whatever the case is. Do you think now that with the advent of AI and the tech developments that we've seen, that there's going to be more time for us to enjoy life, to have fun, because most of the heavy lifting is going to be done by the machines and by AI?
You're absolutely spot on. I mean, the evolution of humankind is now being forced upon us. And so the next step of that is, in the AI, in the Industrial Revolution era, we were measured, our competence was measured by IQ and your outcome-based approach. It actually created something in the world called addiction to certainty. And so we're so addicted to certainty that our brains are wired for certainty, and now there's no certainty. And now there's panic. This is where ADHD comes from and anxiousness comes from. But AI today is an IQ of 155. It doubles every 6 months, which means that it's soon going to be a 310, and then it's going to be at 620, and then it's going to be at 1,240. We've never actually dealt with anything with this level of IQ. And so we don't know what it's going to do, but we also realize that you're not a physical being anymore, as in you're not adding value physically, which means that in the future, you won't be adding value intellectually, because the intellectual work is the next thing that's going to go away. So you've got to ask yourself, what's next? And what's next is the movement from muscles to brain to heart. And where we are moving to now is much more about an emotional, adaptable being that's able to utilize the emotions as the new currency. What this looks like, nobody knows, but we understand that intellectualism is out the window.
Elephant in the room here, John.
Yes.
Right. Isn't it nice to be a futurist, because you could pretty much say anything that you like, and very few people in years to come will hold you accountable based on what you say?
People do. People do. And I have had comments about people coming back to me and saying to me, how did you see that? Or what happened there? Or, but again, it's not about predicting. It's about showing the journey of where we've come from, where we are now, and the extrapolation.
Plotting
into the
on
future.
A graph. You're still plotting a graph, though.
It's
right?
It's plotting a.
You're joining dots. You're joining dots from the past into the future based
also,
on a curve or a trend that you've seen.
And also based on multiple different movements of the rise of AI, social changing, how the kids are behaving today. McKinsey's bringing about a report saying that if you're 10 years old today, you'll have possibly 29 different careers before you stop working. So think about that idea, that the idea that you went to something after school called university is the most ridiculous thing, because uni means one. You're going to do one thing till you die, which is what we did.
Yeah.
Today, 29, meaning that uni might be the worst thing you're going to do. So you almost have to go through another process, poly or multiversity or however you want to name it, but it's about adaptability. It's not about outcome-based.
I read somewhere where when you mentioned about education and university and schooling, that it programs everyone to kind of think and act the same.
Yes.
Right? And that's the killer of authenticity.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
We were prized for fitting into a system. In the Industrial Revolution, the better you follow the system, the more you'd be prized. And the system was school, organizations, citizenship, and religion. And the better religious you were, the more everybody around you thought that you were that religious. Wow, everybody would think you were so amazing. And it was not about your curiosity, fascination, or authenticity at all. It was the better you fitted in, the more you'd be celebrated. In fact, if you were really authentic at school, you were called a rebel. You weren't there to fit into the system.
And you were a rebel when you were younger.
I was terrible at school. And I don't know if I was rebel. I mean, look, I come from a single mom family. There was no male figure managing me, which is also part of it. But I think just my brain is not wired for school. And I left school very demoralized, because it doesn't matter how hard I studied, I just couldn't crack it. I just wasn't that academic person.
So you've mentioned now single mom family twice.
Yes.
In 15 minutes. So yes. That's obviously, it's a big influence on your life.
Huge.
So what role has that played? Had you come from a dual parent sort of home, would that have changed who you are and how
Absolutely.
You approach life?
Absolutely.
In what way?
As a single mom and as a firstborn who's a boy, you play the role of emotional husband and you grow up exceptionally quickly and you have to release your childhood and you never really have a relationship with a dad. Like you don't, and the thing that still gets me at times is I never had backup. You know, you'd go out into the world and nobody was there to watch your back. And so you find that many guys that are aggressive and that are bodybuilders, in fact, and in fact myself as well, are hurt little boys that need to protect themselves. And because there was nobody else there to back them, they became aggressive and became bodybuilders and became gangsters and became all these things that are not based on having backup.
Yeah. And now you're fortifying your mind, you're fortifying your strength from within to be super resilient. That's what you are. Right now, to me, you look like someone who's completely impervious to the outside world. No matter what anyone would throw at you, you're so strong inside. doesn't matter.
Look, it does sometimes matter, but I can get over it quickly. And I do understand how the world works. I do understand that everybody's projecting into this world and it's their own traumas that they're projecting onto me. So I don't take it personally, because I also know that when I project onto somebody, it's got nothing to do with them. It's got to do with how I'm feeling, where I'm feeling, what that person has done to trigger me. So yes, I think understanding the human psyche does allow you that level of distance from that sort of comment.
What have you learned most about your own life? If you're going to plot your own life, you're going to extrapolate your own future. What does your future look like?
I think the equation of ambition has been the biggest thing for me to want to tackle. And I think that where we grew up, we similar ages, the way we grew up was grind hard, work hard, focus, get out there and just give it your all. I think that's outdated. It's exhausting. It's fatiguing. And it also, you never arrive. And so my biggest shift has been shifting away from ambition and shifting towards being so enthralled with my current excitement of work that I'm doing that the outcome is irrelevant. That's the master stroke, is to follow your highest excitement at every moment with no desire for an outcome. And if you're able to get that emotional internal dialogue right internally, it changes everything.
Yeah, but then you've got the financial aspect as well, right?
The finances come.
Doesn't always. Does it always come?
It always arrives when you are being super authentic and following your highest excitement. Think about you arriving at a meeting in your absolute highest energy. People are attracted to that. Mm. And they don't know why they're attracted to it, but they just are. And in that state, you see opportunity. And in that state, you give people benefit of the doubt. Now come into that same meeting strategic. Come into that meeting thinking people are manipulating you. Come into that meeting thinking something's going to go wrong. There's no possibilities.
So manifestation, projections, how important are these to the success of an individual in a career and also outside of a career?
I call it future memories. And my new book's called Future Memories. And
you're writing another book?
Yeah, I'm on 11 and 12 come out this year.
My goodness.
Yeah. And congrats. Actually, I stopped writing books for the last few years because I don't think anybody reads books. And I actually don't think anybody reads books. But I was missing having some container to put my thoughts into.
It's a therapy format.
It's a huge therapy. It's a huge, you know what it is? Feng Shui principle says you want to bring anything new into your life, you have to get rid of the old. And so when you get rid of your old ideas, new ideas arrive. And so a book is really a huge release of a set of thoughts and ideas.
I'm doing something similar, but not in books, but in audio. So I've started recording now my own. First of all, I've got this, right? This is me and a guest talking about things that are important, that are insightful, that are fun, that are interesting, whatever. I also have something that I'm doing now, which is just me recording an audio piece. I do it every week. And it's things that matter to me.
Brilliant.
And whether one person listens or
That's not the point.
Yeah, I feel great about it. And I look forward to it now. Every Monday, sitting upstairs, just turning off everything and being alone in my thoughts and just saying it and putting it out there. And it's so therapeutic. I'm absolutely loving it.
Well done, because I think we need that, especially as men. We have a lot of pressure on us to show up and to fend and to provide.
And by the way, not many people, the percentage of people talking about that, especially men in their 40s plus, is very small.
Because they're embarrassed and because there's so much pressure on us.
Stigma associated with it.
There is, especially in Dubai, dude. I mean, Dubai, we're talking about the highest concentration of millionaires anywhere in the world, you know?
And billionaires, apparently.
And billionaires, yes, true, yeah. Sorry, millionaires. I forgot what city I was
in. Depends on what currency.
Exactly. I'm a billionaire, a few currencies. Look, I think manifestations and this sort of idea of law of attraction has had a woo-woo attached to it. And I think that I like to stay away from those sort of ideas.
What's woo-woo, sorry?
Woo-woo. It's like lentil eating, sandal wearing, Jesus bun, Hessian wearing kind of thing.
Avoid them.
Well, no, I think what they do is they irritate people because they're not fact-led. They're almost like this wishful thinking type of idea.
Spirit-led somehow.
Yeah, and look, I think all of the things are valid, but my mission is to try and get people that are not in that world to engage with that world in a scientific and clear way. And if you realize that you're constantly projecting into the world, you're constantly creating future memories, you're constantly manifesting, constantly. We don't want to think about it like that, you know, right? So there's a few stigmas attached to it. So the way I think about it is that memories have no time attached to them. And if you've ever gone through any trauma when you're younger and you still think about that trauma, that memory didn't happen when you were a kid. It's happening now because you're still thinking about
it. That's why you said earlier, memories are fake. Most of them are fake.
They're all fake. And so for me, future memories is really about trying to live your life based on where you're going, not where you've been. And most people are living their lives based on where they've been because their brain patterning doesn't allow them to switch into developing an idea of where you're going.
So is there a fast track tip or trick to get people thinking outside of being in the past?
Yes.
And to be more about being in the present?
Yes, absolutely.
What is that?
There's many of them. I'll give you two or three. The first one is heal your trauma, because you understand that your personality is based on trauma. And the best way to think about this is, in order to be able to move from past memories to future memories, you have to have very high levels of emotional intelligence. And the best way for you to think about emotional intelligence is to ask yourself this question: how long does it take you to recover from a trigger? If you stay triggered for a long time, your emotional intelligence is low, which means you're not thinking about the future, you're defending the past. And if you triggered for 1 to 5 days, you're just moody. If you triggered for 5 to 10 days, you got a bad temperament. But if you stay triggered for longer than 2 weeks, welcome to your new personality, because now your personality is based on triggers. So how many people do you know that are always angry, that are always upset? I mean, the UK—
I avoid them these days, honestly.
Of course. But the whole of the UK is almost triggered.
Yeah.
It's triggered because everybody's complaining. Everybody's upset.
Nothing works.
Nothing works. And the reason nothing works is that they continuously say nothing works.
I mean, you think about it. It's all about the markets, the stock markets. It's built on confidence. But yeah, it's a human confidence in something else.
Yes.
You make huge amounts of bets based on a feeling, based on, you have indicators and everything else. Yeah. But at the end of the day, the currency is confidence.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Investors.
Which I am still flabbergasted that the pound is still so strong.
Yeah.
Flabbergasted. And what is the UK doing for the world?
It's the myth of the pound. It's the great pound. The empire of the pound.
The old empire.
Yeah, which they're holding on to. You mentioned also that Dubai, talking about the UK, has tremendous amount of legacy, tradition that's keeping it a little bit more, let's say, rooted. It's more difficult to change, to innovate. Dubai, UAE, is totally different. It's a new country, clean slate. How important is that as an individual, your surroundings, playing and unleashing your potential?
It's everything. It really is everything. And I say this to my audiences often, is choose where you live very carefully. It determines how much ambition and how much drive you have. I wrote a chapter in one of my books called The Breathing of Empires. And we are watching the empires of the West breathe out. And we're watching the empires of the East breathe in. And we can see this. And I see it viscerally when I travel, because certain audiences are really scared and certain audiences are really excited. And you go into sort of Europe audiences, not happy.
Yeah.
Very
lethargic,
worried,
down.
Lethargic, down. You go into India, you go into Dubai, there is a huge energy of whatever's possible is ready to go.
These are young populations. So India has a young population, UAE has a young population, UAE is a young country. Right, so there's a certain level of, there's a blank slate where there's everything is on the table. The creativity factor is there.
No past.
Yeah.
Think about having no past. And that's exactly it, is that even in our own psyches, when you have a clean past, all you focus on is the future. What did I say? Future memories. So if you can determine that you can clear your past and just move into the future, you start to be more excited about what you're building and spend more time in rewiring your brain. They filmed brains imagining new possibilities. And I don't know if you know this, but your personality is highways of thought, neurons that are wired and fired together so often that this very entrenched highway keeps you stuck. When you start to imagine new possibilities, new neurons start firing and wiring together. It's quite literally a brain expansion.
You're literally rewiring.
Yeah. But that takes practice.
Yeah. I've done a bit of that.
Yeah.
Changed my life.
Has it?
Yeah.
No doubt.
I had a lot of trauma. I didn't realize half of it.
Yeah. But
the more you go into that sort of subconscious state, it just starts coming out.
What sort of practices have you done?
That's a healing mainly.
Yeah,
so,
good.
So, you know, it was really powerful stuff,
yeah.
I have to say. And at first I was a skeptic. Honestly, I was a skeptic. But then I was like, you know what? What's the worst that can happen?
Yeah.
Worst that can happen is I stay the same.
Yeah.
Some will say that's pretty bad, Luke. but I feel a different person.
Of course.
I feel like there's more inside. The potential that I have is now, it's almost magical. Like if you sense it and you feel it, you can reach out and grab the magic, but you have to believe in it.
Yeah.
It's really and truly. And I'm not all the way there yet, but 6 months ago, a year ago, I wasn't in the best of places, man.
Right.
I made a big life decision. I left a job that I'd been in for a long, long time. And it was a tough time, but I turned to trying to heal myself in order to give myself the best possibility for my kids and for myself and for my wife. And so I started working on that therapy side, and it feels great. It really
well, look, you also recently turned 40.
And yeah, 42. Yeah, 42. Do I look 42? No. I paid you a compliment by being the Persian George Clooney.
Yeah. No.
Feel free to throw it back.
No. I mean, I, you know, we've also got to start to re-engage with what it looks like to be this age. You know, we are aging in very different ways. But also turning 40 as a man is a huge, huge milestone in as far as you having to access a different aspect of yourself. You have to show up differently. And there's been so much literature written on turning 40. And one of my favorite books is called The Midlife Passage, From Misery to Meaning. And in the book, he explains that at 40, for the very first time, your soul comes a knocking and says, who are you and what are you doing here? And if you ignore the heed, you go into crisis. And crisis is measuring success like you did pre-40. That's why if you get a man in a Ferrari and two blondes in a nightclub and he's 55, he's in crisis. He's literally in crisis because he doesn't know how to measure success in a new way. He's still doing what he always did. And he's bitterly unhappy with his Ferrari and his two blonde girlfriends. What passage requires you to do is to go through something called the dark woods. And when you go through the dark woods, you have to let go of your baby fat. You have to let go of that boy that was there and has been trying so hard to really arrive and to meet yourself at the very first time when you come out of the dark woods. And you've come out of the dark woods. And I went through a dark woods, but it took me about 8 months. And when I came out of that dark woods, I began my career. This was only began after I arrived into my 40s.
I really do feel I'm beginning a brand new career, right?
Yeah.
I'm right at the beginning of that journey. Yeah. It's scary as hell.
Of course.
It's super scary.
Yeah, of
no
course.
Idea how it's going to pan out.
Nobody
but
does.
I'm optimistic.
Good.
Right?
Good.
And as long as you stay true to yourself, you've got half a chance. So do you feel there's a correlation between the older you get, historically speaking, there's a stigma that you're not allowed to take risks. So if you're a male and you're in your 20s, you're allowed to have fun. Society says your 20s are there to have fun. It's okay. When you're in your 30s, no, you need to get a bit more serious. Your 40s, you literally have to play it safe because you're no longer thinking about yourself. You're thinking about your family. So do you think there's a correlation between age and risk and how that is really affecting our true capabilities? As well, so the societal pressures as well as the internal vulnerabilities that we may have from a trauma state.
Look, I think the idea of risk also has to be described differently. When you're in your 20s, risk is being dangerous, living dangerously. You know, in your 40s, you want to be living dangerously, but there's other risks. In your 40s, what you want to do, the biggest risk is for you not to become authentic. The biggest risk is for you not to actually access your heart and to start living from that level. So I think you have an awesome... predetermine what those words mean in every one of those stages. You can't, like, if you want to be risky in your 40s like you were in your 20s, no, you're an idiot. Like, what are you doing?
Okay, so you do agree with that?
I do agree, but you also got to determine what risk is where. Yeah. Because the risk in your 40s and 50s is if you're not doing something that brings you joy, it doesn't matter how much money you make. I call it miserable success. So you arrive at your 40s and 50s, you got so much money, but you're a miserable sod. What's the point? That's risk. That's a big risk.
Should we play some risk with the Bulls?
Let's go.
All right, mate. The show is yours. Take the bag. Let's do a ball at a time. Hey, guys. It's me again. Do you get worried about giving a speech or, you know, being on a podcast or being someone that's been told to present in front of their client or to their boss? A lot of people have anxiety when it comes to public speaking. In fact, 74% of every one of us is terrified about the idea of standing in front of other people and trying to convince them of something. The good news is there's a lot of people that can help. In fact, I've launched my own training program, which I'm calling Master Pitch, which combines my 20 years of corporate background running big businesses, dealing with clients, as well as my own personal passion point of presenting in front of large audiences or being on camera, or in fact, even being on the inside track. So if you want to improve things like your tone, your pace, your storytelling narrative and how to structure it properly, as well as to understand your audience better and to drive real impact, I'm sure I can help you out. Whether individual level or at a corporate level, my Master Pitch training program can definitely make you a better public speaker. So drop me an email at info@lukealam.com or check out my website, lukealam.com, if you want to find out more information, more details. Right, let's get back to the show.
And so what, you create these beforehand?
These are written beforehand. So when I do my research, that's why half the conversation before we, you know, so I try and see the conversation a certain way that we don't go into too much detail about a certain topic, but enough that gives it context for the question.
Well done, man.
That's the idea.
Well done. Will the creative economy be mankind's defining achievement?
So this is about really saying that creativity is at the last bastion, right? That's going to keep us human and why we will continue to flourish and be successful.
Yes. Creativity is another way of saying authenticity. It's another way of saying your genius, your brilliance, your fascination, and your curiosity. And we have never been prized to follow those. School was not about that. School was about fitting into the system. That's why I say AI is going to force us to become more human than ever before, because the currency of what we'll add value to in the world will be that creativity, that uniqueness that we'll bring to the table. And most kids today want to be influencers, and people laugh at that. I'm like, what do you want to be an influencer for? What are you going to do? But influencer is really just another way of saying, I want a unique voice. I just want to be able to say what I want to say. I don't want to fit into that system. So I agree, because as human beings, we have been robots and cogs in a machine to bring about efficiencies and profitabilities for organizations and systems. But as that system starts to become demonetized, democratized, and disrupted around us because of AI, what's left behind is our creativity, is our humanness.
So the question is asking, is this, will it be the last defining economy, right? Really for mankind, this creativity. Do you see something coming after creativity? Or do you feel like really this is how we're now going to be gearing ourselves up as people to flourish in this economy specifically?
Look, I think the idea of economy is going to change. The idea of having money is going to change. I think that with blockchain and AI and all these things coming, I think the whole concept of the way we've been thinking about money, about hoarding it and being insecure about it, that's all going to change, because we're moving into a world of hyperabundance. I don't think anybody knows how we're going to show up and what is going to be the exchange that we're going to have there. But I do know that the more human you are, the more open-hearted you are, the more connected you are, the more collaborative you are, the more successful you'll become.
I love the fact that you love the human, you love the heart element,
right? Yes.
The emotional element you mentioned a few times. And that's going to be obviously one of our saving graces as a species,
yes,
is that we have that heart. So there's a romanticism and there's an optimism that I see within you.
Absolutely. Yeah, that, you're right.
Do you look for that in friends and partners?
Absolutely. I can't be around people that are not talking about, I call myself a upward spiral conversation architect. And I'm doing this all the time without people realizing. I've given you a few compliments on our call because I'm watching who you are and what you're doing, but I'm also trying to see the human side of it and make a comment on that to make sure that you see, feel that you've been seen. And I'm constantly doing that to all my friends around me. And if somebody starts to take me off that too much, I disengage.
Okay.
I don't try and change their behavior.
Do you feel like you have to do that because no one else is doing that, but you have that such a high level of EQ that you, it's kind of your role now because you're more enlightened than most people?
I wouldn't say that. I don't feel pressure to do it. It feels obvious for me to do it.
Nice.
And I think what sometimes people say to me after they leave me is they feel so inspired. And the reason they feel so inspired is because I see a bigger potential in them than they do. And that's all it is because I see a bigger potential in myself. And I think I project that potential into somebody, you know?
Beautiful.
So, next one.
Let's do it. Rock and roll.
Educational programming is the true enemy of being authentic. Education makes you to be like everybody else. And I often say to my talks is that how many accountants do you think qualify a year? And how many lawyers? And how many nutritionists? And how many? And what the internet did was it democratized information. And which means that now everybody's got access to the same information, which makes you zero special and makes you now grind on price, nothing else. And so you go and get one degree. It's not enough to get into those big businesses. Now you got to get 2 degrees and then 3 degrees and then 5 degrees and then until when? But actually what I think the future of the world requires is uniqueness. Why? In the world of agriculture, the size of the land determines your wealth. In the Industrial Revolution, your size of your production output determined your success. But that's been taken over by AI and robots. What's going to now become your determinant is the attention economy. And how much people are giving you attention based on your uniqueness now gives you an opportunity to share. Look at all the biggest players that we have around us right now. They all got massive followings. And those massive followings allow them to monetize and scale on a very different level. And the most famous one right now is Diary of a CEO hitting 10 million followers. And what he's doing with that is because he's living in the new economy. And it's not about education. It's about being unique and authentic and showing up like that. Do you know the lady who has Call Her Daddy, the podcast? It's right up there with Joe Rogan's numbers. and I watched an interview with her talking about a podcast, and she's just been given a $125 million contract. And she's just 100% authentic. That's all she is. That's all she is. And that's how she shows up, and people connect with that authenticity. So the future requires us not to fit into the system, but to literally fit out of the system.
So if you're a parent, what are your messages to your kids?
Two things. One, how do you get your kids to access their genius as quickly as possible? And the way you do that is through exposure. Expose them to as many different businesses, people, and careers as possible, as often as possible, and then debrief them. So we went to the hospital. What do you think of it? What did you like about it? What didn't you like about it? Did you like the blood? Didn't you like the blood? What was cool there? Okay, let's go to the animal shelter. What did you like there? What didn't you like? Let's go to the nursery. What did you like there? What didn't you like? Let's go to the law firm.
So exposure.
Exposure.
Mass exposure.
Mass exposure every weekend.
Yeah. To find out, to pinpoint where they feel most passionate.
What I like, what I don't like. What I like, what I don't like. What I don't like. Two.
It's expensive.
Well, look, I mean,
as a parent taking them everywhere.
Fair, but like, I mean, not really, because if you think about it, you're not doing entertainment. You're taking them to expose them to startups and to businesses. You're really just doing a tour of what their genius could possibly be. It's not always about the money thing.
And you think everyone's a genius?
Everybody's got genius inside them. We just haven't accessed it. And so I made a post the other day about becoming a keynote speaker, and I spoke about authenticity and uniqueness being so, so important. And somebody said, yeah, but they have to have something to talk about. I said, anybody that you speak to will have something that they're really passionate about.
What's your genius?
I think it's about simplification and innovation. It's about simplifying the future and to elevate our consciousness towards it. I do that for myself, and I do it at pace. And so I'm able to relate that back to teaching it. And they say that the closing circle of wisdom is teaching it. And so they call it LIT, learn, implement, teach. Learn, implement, teach.
Yeah, acronym of Lucas Inside Track, LIT.
Oh, there we go.
There you go.
Learn, implement, teach. That's what you're doing right now.
There you go.
You're accessing your genius.
Maybe we're interfacing.
Yeah. You're doing well. Cool.
All right, two down. We're on a roll.
Does outsourcing strategic thinking limit organizational development?
So when you outsource strategic thinking, it could be to AI, it could be to a consultancy. Are you really just crippling the organization long-term from within?
Such a good question. I think that existing organizations can't prepare for the future. And I'll tell you why. The system they built on is built on efficiencies, not adaptability. You can't build adaptable systems on efficient systems. You can't tell people to be adaptable, agile, and flexible, but also make sure that your quarterly profits are exactly what the shareholders want from you. It's a totally different idea.
Not even quarterly, monthly.
Yeah, weekly, whatever it may be, right? So what I think what we have to do is build dual teams. And one of my talks, Transformotion, is about the idea of building today and tomorrow teams. And organizations need to restructure. This is the third phase. Simplify, elevate, and restructure. How do you restructure an organization? Because what we are doing is we're asking our existing people to be futurists. And our existing people were never hired to be AI and data scientists. They don't understand that world. And what you do is you're actually asking them, it's like asking Serena Williams to be a golfer. Serena Williams is an excellent tennis player.
Probably better than I am, to be fair.
Sure, fair, but she's not a golfer. And look at Michael Jordan. He tried to play baseball. He was useless. He didn't even feature. So what we've got to do is in our organizations is realize that leave your existing people to do what they're doing. And what I call that is the innovation team. And the innovation team is doing what you've always done, more modified, more efficient. But then you need a disruption team, a tomorrow team. And the way to describe disruption is making your current business model obsolete to create a new business model. You can't do that internally. And I'll give you two examples that right now are happening right in front of our eyes. Have you seen the share price for Zara over the last few years?
Yeah.
19 billion to 11. What happened? Shein arrived from outside, disrupted, brand new business model, economies of learning, economies of scale. Didn't even see it. Didn't even have the awareness to see that as an opportunity. VW, seen the price, share price of VW? What's happened? We've gone from focus on engines to focus on batteries. All of a sudden, not in their awareness, couldn't even see it. So your question is saying, does it cripple them? They're already crippled. They can't see what's coming next because they're so addicted to their existing systems. So I tell all my clients, build a tomorrow team, a jet fighter next to your Boeing. Let that jet fighter sit away from your offices and let them start solving problems 3 to 5 years ahead and allow those to slowly bleed in or create new businesses on their own.
That requires a lot of investment without return.
No, it doesn't. Because the way to build tomorrow teams is based fundamentally on using AI and data at the at the base of your business. Now, the best example to give you is, in order to make $1 million, it used to take 1,000 men, and then it took 100 men, and now it's going to take 10 men, and soon it'll be one man. And so Instagram got sold for $1 billion with 12 people. In a recent interview, Peter Diamandis and Salim Ismail from EXO and Singularity were talking about the first one-person employee company worth $1 billion has already started. Why? Because the systems around us, utilizing the systems around us in the best way possible, you can bring about massive, exponential, scalable businesses utilizing technology with very little manpower. So I don't think it's a big investment at all. I think it's about building a team with no ROI, which has got a small group of people that are gamers, data scientists, AI specialists, machine learning specialists, and let them solve and play and do things. But what most people aren't able to do in organizations is to have a team that has and doesn't have an ROI. Why? Addiction to certainty, quarterly profits, and keeping us efficient and profitable at all costs.
That's what I'm saying. It comes down to the bottom line.
Of course it will come out, but it's a small percentage. It's not a huge investment that most people think.
Is there a certain level of ego also keeping?
Of course. It's a huge part.
How part is it a human issue versus business issue?
It's a system issue.
And not human.
The system has created humans to think in a certain way, and the system has created a business model that doesn't allow you to experiment.
But you know, everyone's scared of change. A lot of people are scared of change, right? So there's this intrinsic fear of the unknown.
But that's why you must create a tomorrow team, because your existing people are fear of
change.
That's
why I would argue that it's more about a human condition, why businesses are slow to react, slow to adapt, because they are scared of that change.
I absolutely agree with you. But remember that the humans are inside a system that says you have to have quarterly profits at all costs. So yes, we've been trained and educated into a way of thinking that prioritizes the system over adaptability. Right. So same, we're saying the same thing, but just the human is the issue, but the human has been trained in the system.
I'm with you. Yeah. Indoctrinated.
We have been indoctrinated. We've been totally duped. And that's okay. It was actually very successful for 200 years, but it's not successful anymore.
Love it. Getting lots of nice sound bites from this.
It's great. Every organization will use AGI. It's only a matter of time, when and how. Nobody knows when and how. And
someone said 2029.
Yeah, there's singularity. There's all these predictions. I don't know. I can tell you directly. And what you're talking about is singularity when computers become smarter than humans, which is 2029, which is the Ray Kurzweil prediction. Look, I don't think organizations will use AGI. I think humans will each have their own AGI. We are moving away from the structure of organizational, because remember, organizations were created to bring efficiencies. We don't need those anymore. They're too slow. They were built for stable worlds. Today, the world's not stable. Organizations can't move quick enough. That's why they're being disrupted. That's why Zara's lost half its share price. And so we're going to see more and more of this. You know, over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see the implosion, like serious implosions of educational systems, of organizational structures, religious structures. All of these are imploding. Financial structures. And think about what's happening with the dollar and Bitcoin and blockchain. All of this is showing us that we're in the last phases of the Industrial Revolution evolving into this new phase. So I think the idea of even organizations won't be around. They will be not necessary in a world that will have that. But I don't think we need to be worried about it, because I think what we'll have is access to so many services around us that it'll be like, we won't even think about them really. And the analogy I always use is, do you remember the first time you used Uber? Do you remember how?
I actually can't remember the first time.
I must have been drunk somewhere.
So, probably, yeah.
But remember that how amazing it was. It was mind-blowing. The fifth time that you used Uber and the taxi wasn't finding you were complaining. That's us as humans. Like, oh, you know, WhatsApp, Nikes, everything free. But just 10 years ago, we were paying a lot of money to call anybody.
I still remember mobile phones before they came out.
Exactly. Yeah. So we realized that it's getting better and better. But the trick is to be optimistic about uncertainty and to be adventurous in exploring these things, you know? But I don't think we want organizations around. Why? There's no need for it. When you have individual connection, hyperabundance, individual selling online.
So all these big blue chip multinational companies, the days are numbered?
Of course they are. And they need to be numbered. But we don't also have to think of it as demise. It's evolution. They were perfect for the world of Industrial Revolution. They were necessary for the world of Industrial Revolution, where human power brought efficiencies and profitability. When you take all of that away, why? It's like asking this, will we working in the farms anymore? Well, no, because you'll have a tractor that's AI driving.
It's robotic.
You know, it's robotics. Why would you even want to be in that space? You won't even be there. I think the stat that I read once was 98% of the human population used to be in agriculture. Today, 1.3% of people are in agriculture and shrinking. So then what does that mean? Is that, must we keep the farms alive like they used to be? No. And organizations are a result of industrial revolution. Would they need to be around? No.
What's your take on the world, the virtual world, and us being plugged into a virtual world and kind of escaping this world and literally living in a completely alternate kind of...
Yes, I think some people will do that. And I think that a lot of us will start to prioritize human connection. And I think that is already what we're seeing. If you look at some of the more mature cultures around the world, Amsterdam, for example, having that cafe that no cell phones are allowed. And we are starting to see a reverse from the need for fast fashion to slow fashion, fast food to slow food, to hyper connection to slow connection. And we're starting to see the turn start to happen.
Content as well, would you say? You're seeing that from short form content to longer form content?
I look at podcasts, 3 hours long. I mean, these people are like, what are you doing? 3 hours? You're talking to somebody?
We need a lot of coffee for 3 hours. Yeah.
But what we do is we break it up. And so we're also in two phases. We're into these 2-3 minute videos, but also we want to go listen to Joe Rogan speak to Elon Musk for 3.5 hours and really get deep into it.
Yeah.
But I also think the future of us is human connection. So, you know, the content will help us. But remember, when a new media is given to us as humans, we don't know what to do with it. Like, we're very clueless of what to do. We have to mature into it. Do you know what the first TV ad ever was?
I should know this, but I used to work in advertising. The first TV ad? No, tell me.
It was a Barbie doll ad in the 1930s, and it was the guy reading the radio ad. That was the TV ad.
Okay.
Like, understand, we didn't understand TV.
Yeah.
All we did was a take radio and like pushed it onto this. And so what have we done on social media? We don't understand it yet. We haven't matured into it. So yes, it's gone haywire and TV. Remember, we had TV dinners and everybody was around the TV at the same TV. We're like, well, don't even think about TV anymore, right? So I think it's a maturing. And I don't think it's anything to panic about. It's an evolution more than anything else.
Okay.
Does the futurist create the change or narrate the inevitable? It's such great questions, dude. I would like to think that I create change. Because if I start to explain to you new possibilities around, and for you to access the new possibilities, I'm quite literally changing the way you think about the future.
Effect.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the success of my career has been based on giving solutions to audiences that are in panic. And the solutions are so simple, are so back to basics that most people don't even think about them.
So give me a common problem and give me a simple solution. What's the common problem most people have?
Complexity is the enemy of execution. AI is too complex. We'll ignore it. It's an IT problem.
So what's the solution?
The solution is to simplify the understanding of AI through a strategic lens, not what AI can do. In other words, do you know what electricity is? No. But you know what a toaster is? Do you know what the internet is? No. But you know what Facebook is? And so where we are with AI right now, for example, people are so caught up in, will it become AGI? What's going to, but you're not thinking about it strategically. Like, how will I use it? In what context will I actually use it?
So will it benefit me?
How will it benefit my business? And so the way I do that is I use I call it the strategic lens, the AI strategic lens. And what I do is I show you four quadrants. I say, okay, you have four quadrants. You have the tomorrow quadrant and you have the today quadrant and you have the sort of like, thinking about customers or internal. And so what most companies are doing are using AI to bring efficiencies to their internal systems. Nobody's thinking about changing the way the customer experiences you. Nobody's really thinking about changing the core offering of your business. And nobody's thinking about changing a whole industry. And so if I show you the strategic lens, you're like, oh, these other opportunities out there, I just need to hire new capabilities and I don't understand it, but I can hire. Here's 10 examples of companies that are doing this and have started here. Oh, okay. I feel relieved that I can be strategic about how I'm going to make decisions.
You think that the fact that everything seemed to come at the same time, whether it's blockchain, metaverse, crypto, it all kind of exploded around the same sort of period, AI. It's just added an additional layer of complexity that's kind of unnecessary and that's made the whole world a little bit dark and scary and mysterious. And that's why people actually want to move away. Had AI come independently by itself, without all the other stuff, maybe we'd look at things slightly differently.
I don't think you can do that. I think these things come in convergence, you know, because you have people are working on robotics and you have people working on metaverse and you have people working in all these sort of places and they're just converging. And think about this, is that you need these things to come in to bring in the new world. And we are ending a world. And so there's something called The Fourth Turning. Have you heard of it? It's a book that came out in 1996 that revolutionized our idea of cycles inside the world. The guys who brought out the book in 1996 brought out a book in 1986 called Generations. And they introduced the human population to Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Z, and baby boomers. And so all of a sudden, from 1986, we understood that people had different behaviors and measured success in different ways based on generations. In 1996, they did further research and they realized that humanity is going through something called the saeculum. And a saeculum is a plus minus 80-year cycle that we've been going through. And they tracked it back to the 1600s. And we've been going through almost the same 80-year cycle. And these 80-year cycles have four seasons in them. They have spring, summer, autumn, and winter. And the last time an 80-year cycle ended was 1946. What happened in 1946? World War II. What happened to the 20 years leading up to 1946? We had war, social unrest, financial collapse, and job unemployment. And guess what's happening again now? And what's where we are right now is in the fourth quarter or the fourth turning of the saeculum that started in 2008. And in their book in 1996, they said, if our prediction or our research is correct, in 2008, we should start with a financial crisis. The book became a bestseller in 2008.
That's crazy.
It stayed invisible till 2008. And so they preempted this 20-year period that is all about winter. And what happens in winter? Everything dies. And in order for us to understand what happened in 1946, we realize that from 1947 to 1964, we had the space race. We had new TVs arriving. We had so much new technology arriving that was incredibly disruptive.
John, I love this. I love this. Like my eyes are just opening.
Good. Beautiful. So we are in winter and we have another 3 years of winter to go. And so the next 3 years of winter, we'll see more implosion. And the reason I bring this up is it's important to know what clothes you need to wear when you wake up in the morning. If you're waking up every day thinking it's summer or you think you want it to be summer, but it's winter, you're going to be a miff person.
So that goes back to the society where I was saying how much that impacts you around you as an individual.
Yes.
So if we are in winter and our things are coming to an end, that's going to bring you down, isn't it?
No. If you're armored correctly, it won't bring you down.
So winter is coming, but it doesn't happen.
Winter's here. And we're in winter.
I just had to get the Game of Thrones reference.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
You were Game of Thrones
guy? Yeah, I was for the first three episodes, then I got bored.
Okay.
But I loved it. I mean, what an incredible story. But we're in winter, and we have another 3 years of winter to go. So I'm excited about more implosions, because to be honest with you, were people really happy? They weren't. Like, people were grinding away with all the conveniences around the world. The world's more anxious, more lonely, and more Prozac than ever before. So what's the point of that?
Never felt more alone.
Exactly. With all the
connectivities.
With all the connectivity.
Love it.
And so we should be celebrating the endings of this.
2028 is the birth of a new world. The next cycle, let's say.
The next cycle. And we are seeing the end of the cycle. And it's okay. And it's happened before. And it will happen again. And so we don't see ourselves as cyclical. And we should see ourselves as cyclical. Even in our seasons. We have seasons. You know, we don't always have summer.
Mate, find it.
The movie series that had the best, worst predictions of the future.
This is a fun one.
Yeah. I refused to watch Black Mirror.
Okay.
And I didn't want to imprint my mind with any of the possibilities of that. And I think what we have to realize is that, and I used to introduce myself in my talks that I'm a futures strategist. I am a plural future strategist, not a singular. And if we collectively keep thinking of the negativity of technology, we then quite literally develop timelines that we start to experience those worlds in.
So has there ever been a movie that you used to watch in the 80s or the 90s growing up and thought, that would be an amazing future?
Back to the Future, obviously.
Yeah, you like that movie?
When we put that pill into the microwave and it became a pizza.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I was like, dude, I want those pills now.
Have you ever watched something that's sort of like, you know, that's eerily ended up being quite correct?
I think the closest thing that I'd like maybe to come into fruition, and maybe I've experimented with a few things, was Limitless.
Okay. Yeah.
Instead of having Limitless.
Pill. Yeah, yeah.
Give me yours.
Star Trek. So okay.
Of course.
There's a lot of people, big Trek. I'm not a Star Trek guy.
Yes. But I think we're too young for it. I think you have to be a little bit older if you're
a Trekker. A lot of the stuff that they talked about, that like the iPads, kind of stuff was before. Something called the holodeck.
Yes, that's right.
You know about the holodeck? Where they go into a room and they basically imagine anything that they like and it takes you to that place. Mm. Same sensations. You want to be on the top of Everest.
Mm.
In that room, you'll feel like you're on Everest because your mind is so tricked based on the realities that's been created.
Brilliant.
I had a guy who came on the show and he talked about the holodeck. He talked about how that's only a matter of time. We're just literally just we're filling in the gaps between now and then.
There's something called
crazy is that?
Unbelievable. Whoever wrote that was totally tapped into something. But they just recently finished it's called the X Prize in America. And then what they do is they solve global grand challenges. And so they raise money, $2-3 million, $4 million. And they say, okay, around the world, what we want is we want to create the solution to this. And their last challenge was to create a Star Trek scanner that would figure out your health by just scanning you based on the Star Trek story. And somebody did it.
Yeah.
So yeah, Star Trek, you're absolutely right. Thank you for that. Cause Star Trek definitely, preempted and predicted a lot.
How close are we to having stuff being put inside us from a medical perspective?
It's already happening.
Nanotechnology.
You can have pre-programmed viruses that are positive that can go in and maneuver their way into your body. We have CRISPR-Cas9. Do you know that? The DNA strand cutting out and replacing. From CRISPR-Cas9 used to cost $100 million to have your DNA sorted. Today it's $7. And what you can do is CRISPR-Cas9 picks up on the DNA strands that could possibly cause heart disease. In fact, 3,200 diseases that you can take, you can cut your DNA and replace it with CRISPR-Cas9. So there's so much of this happening out there that's in labs. It's still in what I call the deceptive phase of technology. And it's always bubbling until it pops.
Yeah, 3 years probably with the new cycle. What are the industries? Give me three industries that are already massively impacted by AI and probably won't be around.
Law, accounting, auditing,
so the legal, consulting. The legal system, totally. Accounting, and?
Consulting. I mean, we all know these days the best strategist that you can have is ChatGPT. Ask it questions. The depth of its understanding is way beyond. And I think that I've had a couple goes with them online, is the strategic companies that want the big four and those ones are part of the problem. They are built for the Industrial Revolution and were excellent at bringing about strategies in the Industrial Revolution. But they also blinkered by not seeing new opportunities out there. And you can get a lot of the same programs that they're doing based on ChatGPT and
all the most ironic thing out of all of this is that I feel the one industry that needs the most amount of change and that teaches for the future is supposed to be education.
Yes.
And it's archaic.
Yes. But you've got to also understand that they don't know what's next. And so they also are lost because their systems was about fitting into the system.
Exactly.
The system is not around.
It's not prepared.
It's not. But it doesn't know how.
So then what do you do? If you're like, again, you've got kids and they're 11, they're 12, right? Do you want to put them into university? Do you want to go down the traditional route? Or would you advocate saying, you know what, go out and experiment with everything. And then, you know what, take a job by 16 and go and develop code. I don't know. What would be your advice for parents who are worried about the future for their kids?
Yeah. It's so funny. I had lunch with a very good friend of mine on the weekend. He has a 17-year-old boy and wonderful kid, Daniel. And Daniel's started DJing and he has a clothing brand and he's very entrepreneurial. And they were saying, what should we do with Daniel? They're asking me the same question. I said, you know what you should do? Go do a 6-month course in music. Go do a 6-month course in design. Go do a 6-month course in digital marketing. Go do a 6-month course. Go do a 6-month course. Learn from the best and everything that you love already. You're already ahead. You're already ahead of your peers. Why would you want to go do a course that makes you look like everybody else? Go and take what you are already super excited about, fast track that, and then learn how to distribute it around the world. And so for me, it's about your uniqueness and magnifying that uniqueness. Now, I was watching a documentary, and actually the idea came to me from watching a documentary about what are billionaires doing with their kids. Do you know billionaires are not putting their kids in university?
I don't know any, sorry, mate.
Well, you're in Dubai. You must know at least a handful. But the billionaires are not putting their kids into university. Why? Too slow. So what they do is their daughter loves design. Go find a tailor in Bond Street and shadow him for 6 months. And I love interior design. Go to Milan. Go spend 6 months over there. You'll fast track your learning so much quicker, so much better on the ground. And then the trick is do you want your children to be employed or do you want to be free? And obviously free gives you an opportunity to be non-geographic, to be expressive, to be totally authentic. And that's really what you want for your kids. So if you want them to have a job, then university would be the right way to go. But if you want them to be free, you would want them to access their uniqueness and then accentuate that uniqueness.
So if you're a lawyer, if you're an accountant or you're a consultant, John, what's your advice?
Start exploring your authenticity.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not joking, because already we can see law is being replaced by agentic thinking. You've heard about agentic thinking. It's all over the social medias. But I know companies in America hiring agentic thinking engineers to replace aspects of their law firm. And that just starts with aspects and then it does this. And the old adage that your job won't be replaced, you won't lose your job. You'll lose your job to somebody who knows how to use AI, something like that, right? That's dated. Because AI soon with agentic thinking is going to be replacing our own individual sort of processes, you know? And also remember, technology is slow until it isn't. It's slow, slow. No, it's far away. It means that it's bubbling under. It's in different labs and in different, it's getting quicker, cheaper, faster. And then it converges. And then all of a sudden it pops up and WhatsApp arrives and changes every telco business model. Every telco in the world could not sell minutes anymore. And in South Africa, I was at the Vodafone event. I was doing a talk and the CEO stood up and said, you know what's so funny? We are changing our whole business model based on an app that we are all using. We cannibalized our own business. And so that's what's going to happen to all of them. And the next one is transportation. So transportation also will start becoming free or become a service, just like photos and communication and all these things have gone through.
I've got to ask, teleportation, is that ever going to happen? And how far are we from teleportation? You mentioned transport, just triggered me.
Yeah. I do think that's coming, and I do think it's not within our understanding of the concept of the way we see space and time. And to really understand how that would work is we have to redevise what space and time look like. And we are very addicted to a linear timeline, whereas the people that are able to do that, or the interdimensional beings that are able to do that, have understood time in a different way and space in a different way. But then now we're going on a different track of a conversation. Humans' fear of change is bigger danger than regenerative AI. No, I think they're both big dangers. I don't think regenerative AI is a danger. You know, I think regenerative AI is going to create a world of hyperabundance, and it's going to help us evolve into new beings. The people that don't want to change will be left behind. And the ones who don't want to change, you're from the UK, you know, the Luddites, we have Luddites around us, you know, and sometimes the more successful you've been, the less you need to change. And so really change becomes your most important skill, the adaptability of it. But I wouldn't put AGI into a danger space at all. It's an evolution space.
But humans' fear of change is a danger.
That's the biggest danger.
That's what,
yeah. But you said, which one is? I'm like, regenerative isn't. Change is the biggest one. And so our brains and the lack of adaptability.
So what is it about change that worries people up so much?
Unfamiliarity.
And so dig deeper. What is that like? Is it an insecurity issue? What is it, a threat? What is it that makes people feel?
Okay, good. I'll get into it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Open it. Get the old sleeves up.
Yeah. Let me, because there's a little bit of I need to contextualize it for you. The educational system in the world has created an outcome-based thinking pattern within us. And this outcome-based pattern has created a brainwave in our brains called a high beta brainwave. And we've all, mostly people around the world, are addicted to something called a high beta brainwave. And what this high beta brainwave says to you is that you're in danger. There's adrenaline fueling through you, and you're constantly in an anxious state trying to solve problems and hold on to some level of control. And it was Elizabeth Gilbert from Eat, Pray, Love. She said, oh, darling, you never had control. You just had anxiousness. And so this addiction to anxiousness is really perpetuated by the world that we live in that is constantly addicted to the certainty. That's why you can't change, because you can't change when you're in danger. You can only change when you're relaxed. And so what we have to do is practice moving our brainwaves into a brainwave called an alpha brainwave. And what an alpha brainwave is the brainwave you have when you come back from a holiday. And the way I describe it to my audiences is, think about your brain as a car. Imagine your car in second gear revving at 7,000 revs. What's going to happen to that car? It's going to get sick. It's going to die. It's going to break apart, which is what's going on in our society. What you want is a car revving at 3,000 revs and cruising. And in that cruising state, you see opportunity, you explore them, you let go of your past, you engage with what you don't understand. You're quite comfortable in that process. And so what we have to do is change the revs. So change is dependent. Your ability to change is dependent on the revs of your engine. And if the revs of your engine are anxious, adrenaline-fueled, frustrated, and not processing emotions, you're not changing.
How often are you on holiday?
20 years ago, I read a book called The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. And he started off the book, he was cycling across China 2 years. And he had built a business that he only had to work 4 hours. And one of the chapters in that book was called Red BMW. And he was talking about these poor people that...
Oh, you've got a great memory.
Thank you.
You read something 20 years ago. Yeah. You remember the name of the chapter?
You know why? I'll tell you why. Because he was dissing me and I agreed with him.
Okay.
So he called it the Red BMW. And he said some poor sods work all week to own a Red BMW and then drive it around their suburb all weekend. That's their lives. You know, they're trapped in a prison. And I looked out my window, dude. I had a black M3. And I looked at my black M3 and I was like, dude, this guy's talking about me. I was a prisoner of my businesses and my car to be able to look cool in my area. And I decided there and then I want to build a life called a workation. And I want to live a world that I'm constantly on working and on vacation. And that's exactly what I've done. It's like last year we did 65 cities. And every talk I do, I try and stay one or two more days, explore the city and experience what's out there. And so I do think I do live a workation lifestyle even now. So yes, I like to think that.
Mate, it's super inspiring. Yeah. Do you know how difficult it is for people right now listening, watching, who have a 9-to-5, they have the corporate grind,
yeah,
and they feel they have no choice.
Yes.
They are stuck. They yes. are. They have responsibilities. They have kids.
Yes.
What's your message to these people?
What emotional work have you done? And they'll say to you, zero. That's your problem. It's because your idea that you think you're stuck is because you've got low emotional intelligence. And so what I always like remark to my audiences is we spend billions of dollars on going to gym and looking good and smelling good and getting our hair done. But we spend almost $0 on making sure our internal dialogues are comfortable, at peace, optimistic, zero. And some girls will go to therapy because females are more susceptible and open to emotional adaptability. Men, totally not. Emotionally embarrassed by going
There's
to therapy.
Stigma, exactly.
There's a stigma. But get over it, dude. Look, get over it because you know what? And it happened to me. Your third Rolex, your second Mercedes-Benz, your fourth Porsche, and you're unhappy. What's the point, dude? Like, what are you doing? You're on Prozac drinking vodka on a Wednesday morning having an affair. For what? And then what happened?
And do you feel like you're going to, if you don't make those changes, you're going to pass them on invariably to your kids?
Of course. Without a doubt. There's a great quote that says, your actions are so loud, I can't hear a word you're saying. And so if you're doing it for your kids, great. But surely you just want to do it for yourself, you know, to find that level of peace.
Yeah, 100%. How many have you got left, by the way? I'm curious. Is this the last one? Or is there two more?
Go on, last one.
All right, last one.
Crystal ball prediction. When will AI achieve sentience? Yeah, I don't know. Again, I think this
question... What is sentience? Explain what sentience is.
To be self-aware.
To have a human state,
to be self-aware.
Emotional intelligence and self-aware.
Yes. The question for me is not important. Because what the question also is trying to do... Why? Who cares?
Like, because a lot of people want to know.
Yeah, but it's a dumb question. No offense. Because the truth is, when will a truck be stronger than a human?
Yeah.
Who cares? Like, it's already stronger. And when will AI's IQ be higher than ours? It already is.
Because we're holding on to the fact that we are human and they can never be human.
Yes.
But if they start to act and think and behave like humans.
Yes, but our current type of human, you're not taking into account your own evolution. What the question says is we've capped our intelligence. There's no more. Oh my God, it's coming to eat our breakfast. But what about your evolution? And what about you who already evolved from an agricultural person? And think about our dads. What sort of jobs do they have and how much do they stay in their corporate jobs forever? We're not like that anymore. We've already evolved. And so we have to continuously think about our evolution. This question doesn't bring into account our evolution.
Yeah. So, you think these questions are AI-driven or human-driven?
I'd like to think AI. I'd like to think that it was a combination between human and AI. What were they?
They were human.
Were they? Well done.
The idea is if you can answer a question around the circumference of a golf ball,
yes,
it's short enough, not a long-winded question.
Nice.
But you need to have some sort of play on words and it needs to be somehow relevant to that.
Look, I would have used AI.
Yeah.
So if you haven't, then that's great.
I've got one more for you.
Okay.
This is the blank ball.
Oh, okay.
Okay. You can ask anything you like or you can say anything that you haven't said already. Power is yours, John.
What are you doing? What are you doing? Where are you going? What's your story?
Man, who knows?
Yeah. What do you want to do with this? What are you doing with this pod?
I'm doing something that I love first and foremost. Like I love this.
You're excellent at it.
Thank you very much. I'm enthralled in it. I love listening to people. I love learning. I'm curious by nature. And what I also want to do with this is to build a career where I can bring the best out of people
yes.
and produce quality content that people can be inspired by.
Very good.
And I think I have a gift for it.
Yes.
Now it's about how do you make sure you can also make money from it?
Yes.
So Diary of a CEO, Joe Rogan Experience have that longevity, they have the consistency, but at the end of the day, they have a strong enough product of being a person who they are in the hopes that they can start to influence and inspire millions of people around the world. The problem in this world, in my opinion, is that the content that we have, the accessibility on social to anybody, especially my children when they're older, is going to be pretty poor quality content. It's in it for gimmicks. It's in it for short-term laughs. Oh, share this. Oh, it's quite funny. It's not interesting anymore, or it's not particularly insightful because I've challenged myself to speak to people that I would not normally speak to and put myself in positions that I wouldn't normally be. Who the hell am I to talk to someone like you about this or a gamer about something else or someone who works as a mechanical engineer in aviation? I don't have the history in that, but it's about bringing out the best in that person to inspire others. And it's about also making money for myself.
And how do you monetize this?
At the moment, I'm not. I'm not making any money. This is the beginning of a journey.
Right.
And I'm playing the long game, not playing the short game. Look, there's other things that I'm doing on the side, right? So if people want to be good on camera, if they want to stand on stage and be feel confident, I give a lot of training courses when it comes to that kind of stuff. So that's good for me.
Yeah.
Events and hosting, all that kind of stuff as well.
Right,
this is my bread and butter because at the end of the day, I want to create a platform of great stuff, great content that people will be inspired by.
Yes.
And I can excel at doing what I love doing.
Yes.
That's what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's great. So your personal brand, you're building your personal brand,
I want to be seen, and I'm sharing my dreams out loud, but I basically want to be seen as the best interviewer or the best chat show host in the world.
Wow.
That's the ambition.
Wow.
That's the ambition.
That's fantastic.
And I've never said that before.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for.
So I want to get to that stage. The reason why I don't say that is because I've just started this journey.
That's
great. I've been doing this less than a year. So it's a very, very long journey, but I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, yeah. And you're very good. I think the preparation you've done is better than I've ever seen, to be honest. And the way you were reading off my bio yesterday, I was like, dude, where'd you even pick up all of that stuff? Right? Like, you've had to go to multiple different places to get those information. So well done. I also think that you are working towards the more modern economy. Like I said, the attention economy, monetizing that attention economy and building scalable businesses from that, utilizing technology is really where we're going. You know, to be employed, I think will be something to be like old ideas.
I want to be in a situation where, you know, people are saying, Luca, hey, do you want to come talk here? Look, I've got some training. And I can pick and choose the types of people that I also want to work with as well, because If you're commoditizing your time, and that's it, you're quite limited in that. So if you're going to use time as your commodity, which I am at the moment, I want to maximize it.
Of course. And the more famous you are, the more people pay.
Yeah.
And I've shared a stage with Jay Chetty a few times.
Yeah.
And he's terrible on stage, but he earns six times more than me. And he's excellent at podcasting and he's excellent there, but on stage he was terrible. But fame. You know, attention economy is really where we're at right now. So congratulations.
Thank you. Look, I think when I was in my 20s and my 30s, I always had this in the back of my mind, but I was honestly shit scared. I was shit scared because who am I? Who am I to have a voice, to say this stuff, to create a platform? I rebranded my show's name. It used to be called The Inside Track with Luca Allam. The Luca Allam was tagged on at the end.
Right.
Season 3, I flipped it.
Okay.
It's Luca's Inside Track.
Oh, very nice.
So I flipped. That's where the LIT, the lit comes from.
Right, very
so
nice.
I've tried to make it more about me because I was very uncomfortable with being the star of my own show.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But here I am. Here I am with you.
Well, it's been wonderful.
Mate, it's been a pleasure having you, John. Look, like I said, after 8 minutes, you're an incredibly interesting person. You're fascinating. You have unbelievable resilience inside. And I really wish you all the very best with all the books that you do, with all the podcasting that you're doing, with all the future TED Talks that you're going to still have.
Thank you.
You're a great guy. I wish the future for you is as abundant as you want it to be. And good luck with everything.
Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you on stage soon.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Guys, thank you for watching. Please like, share, and comment. And see you soon on Luca's Inside Track.